34. On July 14, 1978, Cooper attended a meeting of the Special Political Committee, United Nations General Assembly, in Miami, chaired by Secretary General Kurt Waldheim, specifically to discuss the UFO question, following repeated requests by Sir Eric Airy, Prime Minister of Grenada, for a full debate. Later that year, Cooper wrote a letter to Ambassador Griffith, Mission of Grenada to the UN, setting out his position, prior to the debate, which was held in the General Assembly on November 27 that year. "I believe that these extraterrestrial vehicles and their crews are visiting this planet from other planets, which obviously are a little more technically advanced than we are here on Earth. I feel that we need to have a top-level, coordinated program to scientifically collect and analyze data from all over the Earth, and to determine how best to interface with these visitors in a friendly fashion. I have not yet had the privilege of flying a UFO, nor of meeting the crew of one." He went on to add that, while serving with the Air Force in Germany in 1951, he had 2 days of observations of many flights of them, of different sizes, flying in fighter formation over Europe. They were at a higher altitude than we could reach with our jet fighters of that time. In referring to astronauts, Cooper revealed that there are several of us who do believe in UFOs and who have had occasion to see a UFO on the ground, or from an airplane. There was only one occasion from space which may have been a UFO. 35. Gordon Cooper was more forthcoming in a recorded interview in New York 5 years earlier. "I myself have encountered some of their craft while flying in space," he told a reporter. "NASA knows this and the American government knows it too. Yet they continue to keep their silence, probably in order to avoid confusing the public." He went on, "For many years I have lived with a secret, in a secrecy imposed on all specialists in astronautics. I can now reveal that every day, in the USA, our radars capture objects of a form and composition unknown to us. I was furthermore a witness to an extraordinary phenomenon that happened a few months ago in Florida. I saw with my own eyes a defined area of ground being consumed by fire with 4 indentations left by a craft, which had descended in the middle of a field. Beings had left the craft. There were other traces to prove this. They seemed to have studied the topography. They had collected soil fragments and eventually returned to wherever they had come from, disappearing with enormous speed. I happen to know that the authorities did just about everything to keep this incident from the press and TV. Flying saucers are a reality. I won't stop repeating this," Cooper concluded. "The public must be prepared to make contact with people who, sooner or later, will be compelled to interfere. The salvation of us all depends on it." 36. During my correspondence with Cooper, he neither confirmed nor denied the statements contained in this interview. "I am intrigued by Cooper's remark in his letter to Ambassador Griffith, 'I have not yet had the privilege of flying a UFO.' A few years ago, a respected colleague informed me that, following the UN meetings, Cooper had vented his frustration at the seemingly invincible task of convincing UN delegates of alien reality. 'What would it take,' he said to the researcher, 'a landed flying saucer?' He went on to claim that he had been in a position to actually pilot a flying disc and land it himself. An outrageous claim, to be sure. Yet from a few other reliable sources I have learned that a number of astronauts and pilots, not exclusively in the United States, have flown alien and or replicated alien vehicles, as we shall learn later." Cosmic Journey, in Alien Contact, I discussed at length the official plan by the US government, NASA, Rockwell International, and other organizations for a space-related traveling exhibition, to include 5,000 to 6,000 square feet of UFO-related materials. A synopsis is warranted here. In 1989 I had been approached by Robert Kirch Jessner, director of a special group associated with Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey International, who had invited me to become the official consultant on UFO research to the Special Development Group. A personal meeting in Orlando, Florida, was a prerequisite. We agreed on a date, October 12. However, although I was on a research trip in Gulf Breeze, Florida, at the time, difficulties with airline schedules arose, and to my everlasting regret, as it transpired, I was obliged to cancel the appointment. On my return to the UK, Kurt Chesner explained that the project had reached a critical stage. Could I recommend someone else? I didn't hesitate to name my friend Bob Exler, pronounced Exler, a former NASA engineer who had worked on the space shuttle arm at the Goddard Space Flight Center and Greenbelt, Maryland. As it transpired, the Cosmic Journey exhibition was to include a mock-up of the shuttle, perhaps also owing to his background in the Air Force. Bob turned out to be the right man for the job. He had joined in 1968, serving mostly with the American Forces Radio and Television Service in the continental United States. During the Vietnam War, he served in Cambodia, Laos, and Thailand, during which period some of his work required top-secret clearance, when each month he was flown by helicopter into the Demilitarized Zone, DMZ, to film classified prototype weapons systems. On returning to the U.S., he spent a year and a half at Wright-Patterson AFB. Bob's meetings with the Special Development Group took place in Orlando on November 1 and 2, 1989. After signing a non-disclosure agreement, he was briefed on the project. Cosmic Journey, as it was called, would be a review of, and a future look at, the space programs of the United States and the Soviet Union. The board of advisors included former astronauts Alan Bean, Eugene Cernan, Charles Conrad, Alexei Leonov, and Thomas Stafford. The project had the approval of President George Bush, Vice President Dan Quayle, and the National Space Council. The latter was chaired by the Vice President and included the Director of Central Intelligence, the Secretary of State, and the Secretary of Defense. With the cooperation of NASA and Rockwell International, the exhibition was to include a full-scale mock-up of the shuttle, a 15,000-square-foot space camp, representations of alien life forms, and, I was told, a post-show exhibit of 5,000 or 6,000 square feet on UFOs. Additionally, the program was to involve a tri-level educational curriculum for 25,000 schools in the United States, due to commence on New Year's Day 1990.37, on November 13, 1989. Bob reported to the Pentagon for a meeting with Thomas P. Stafford, Lieutenant General, USAF, RET, a former fighter pilot, who flew F-86D Sabre jets among others. He later became an astronaut, piloting Gemini V for the first rendezvous in space and commanding Gemini 9. He was also the commander of Apollo 10 in May 1969, the first flight of the lunar module, performing the first rendezvous around the moon and the entire lunar landing mission, apart from the actual landing itself. He logged his fourth space flight as Apollo commander of the Apollo-Soyuz test project mission, July 15-24, 1975, a joint space flight culminating in the historic first meeting in space between American astronauts and Soviet cosmonauts. 38, Stafford turned out to be the intelligence community contact for Cosmic Journey. Following some bizarre sensations generated by an unusual type of detector at the security check, Bob proceeded to the general's office, accompanied by a guard. Stafford discussed exhibits for the project, asking Bob where he planned to obtain material for the kiosks to show UFO case histories and photographs. Stafford indicated that NASA and the CIA's National Photographic Interpretation Center, NPIC, would be good places to start. One of the more intriguing elements of the discussion, Bob told me, involved an exhibit showing an alien, ET corpse. As a reference, the general showed me an 8x10-inch color photo of what appeared to be an alien in a cryogenic tank, a space-age-looking coffin with blue tube lighting inside the clear Lexan cover. It was difficult to see too much in the way of detail, so it's virtually impossible to know if this was real, and the general didn't enlighten me. It looked like one of the so-called gray types, but the chin was much more sharply pointed than is usually described. I could see evidence of the bug eyes, but there was a sort of covering over them. The general seemed to be concerned about using the real thing versus a mock-up, querying Bob about his thoughts on public perception. Bob suggested that displaying a companion autopsy report with color photographs might lend credibility. The possible exhibition of an actual alien corpse was proposed quite seriously. As a matter of fact, Bob added, I got the impression they had a lot of bodies to choose from. The general also had the same concerns about showing a real, versus a mock-up, graft, and, I suggested that the real thing would be preferable if on-board access for the public could be achieved. The other primary areas of discussion involved my robotics experience and the minor role that I had played in the development of the space shuttle arm, which was initially designed to provide life support to astronauts and a diagnostic instrument for repairing satellites in orbit. 39. Bob had expected further contact with General Stafford, but none was forthcoming, probably related to the fact that funds for the project apparently stalled. In late 1996, I invited Stafford and his wife Linda to drinks and dinner at his hotel in London. It was a great privilege listening to this modest pioneer as he answered my questions about the flight to the moon in Apollo 10 in May 1969. Naturally, at one point during the meal, I asked about Bob Exler's claim to have met him in the Pentagon back in 1991. Bob who? He expostulated. He denied having met him or even having had an office in the Pentagon at that time. 40. For a while, I believed Stafford. However, a combination of several circumstances, including Bob's unwavering insistence that he had indeed been invited for a meeting with Stafford in the Pentagon, caused me to change my mind. During the second week of January 1990, Bob was billeted at NASA Ellington Field, also known as Ellington Air Force Base, near the Johnson Space Center in Houston, where he was asked to assist in reconfiguring the movements of the shuttle arm from a zero-gravity environment to that of ordinary gravity, according to the project's requirements. But first, he told me, he was required to become accustomed to how it worked in microgravity. Together with some astronauts and engineers, he was flown by helicopter to a NASA facility about 20 miles southwest of Ellington, where he changed into special clothing in preparation for entry into another room. He stepped through a hatch into this other room, and became airborne. It was weird, because it's like the loss of equilibrium and everything, he explained. Obviously, the astronauts had done a lot of training, they were so accustomed to it, and they were laughing at me. You learn to skip around, and it takes about 15 minutes to become accustomed to the biomechanics, and feels almost similar to getting into a pool of water. The arms tend to swing out. No more than about 8 astronauts or engineers worked on a variety of projects in the chamber at any one time, Bob told me. The chamber measured about 30 feet long, 20 feet wide, and 9 feet high. Recessed in the ceiling was a strange, plasma-like light, which Bob felt was responsible for generating microgravity. Everyone was wearing the same clothing, several of the others I knew, but they really wouldn't let us talk among ourselves. It was pretty much forbidden to talk about anything that had to do with what we were doing. In January 1990, Bob was invited to visit a North American Aerospace Defense Command, NORAD, installation in the Gulf of Mexico. He traveled in one of 3 sleek, black NORAD helicopters. You couldn't see where the door was until it popped open, he said. The helicopter was relatively quiet, sounding more like a humming noise. Bob believes that a highly advanced type of propulsion was being utilized, possibly deriving from alien technology. In any event, the over 500-mile flight lasted amazingly no more than 45 minutes, a speed well in excess of that of the world's officially fastest helicopter, the Sikorsky X-2, which in 2010 reached the unofficial speed record of 288 miles per hour in level flight. The X-2 is known as a compound helicopter. In addition to 2 4-blade main rotors set one above the other, it also features a propulsory 6-blade propeller that produces forward thrust. 41, of related interest, in a 2002-2003 Discovery Wings Channel program on the future development of the U.S. Army's Boeing Sikorsky RA-66 Comanche helicopter, former director of Army Acquisition Bud Foster revealed, I think Comanche will be flying in 2050. In my opinion, it is the last pure helicopter the Army will ever develop. We may be into anti-gravity machines after Comanche. The black helicopter landed on what looked like an oil rig platform, possibly 20 miles south of Pensacola, Florida. It turned out to be a NORAD facility. Bob was taken to a control room with consoles and a huge screen, the latter seemingly with a three-dimensional quality and displaying about a third or fourth of the southeast quadrant of the United States. It had altitude to it as well, and the entire area was covered with a grid that was moving, added Bob. At one point, a series of blips moved across the top part of the screen, there were five, as I recall, and they were labeled, like a typical radar screen where blips usually designate aircraft. These particular ones that were up top were all labeled ASC, they didn't have any specific numbers, just ASC, I overheard someone say, alternative spacecraft. And they came down and spread out, all five of them. Two immediately went off the screen to the northwest and one came around the Gulf Horn. Almost as if they were following the shoreline. There was one, possibly two, I forget, that stopped what looked like just across the border of Florida into Georgia, and, as soon as it stopped, it glowed, there was like a red glow that came off of it. I don't know what that meant. After about 45 minutes at the NORAD facility, Bob and the others were flown back to Ellington. 42, plans for the Cosmic Journey exhibition were temporarily shelved in early 1990, ostensibly for budgetary reasons. And the project directors denied that they ever had any plans to exhibit anything other than mock-ups of aliens or flying saucers. They also denied that Bob Exler was ever employed as a consultant. NASA, too, denied that Bob had visited the places he said he went to. On June 5, 1991, I had a brief meeting with astrophysicist Colonel, later Brigadier General, Simon Pete Worden, at that time Director, Advanced Concepts, Science and Technology, National Space Council, NSC, Executive Office of the President. The meeting took place in the NSC offices at the old Executive Office Building, now the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, adjoining the White House. I asked Worden if he knew anything about the fate of the Cosmic Journey project, and if he was aware of any plans to include extraterrestrial hardware in the exhibition. He replied that he knew of no such plans, and that the exhibition had been cancelled owing to the Spanish government's withdrawal of its financial support. He promised to keep me informed if he learned anything more. I did not hear from him again. In February 1992, I wrote to Vice President Dan Quayle, chairman of the NSC, seeking information on the status of the project, alluding to the alleged plans to feature an extraterrestrial body and/or craft. I received a reply from Jack Schmidt, NASA Exhibits Coordinator. There were plans to have the exhibition at Expo 92, he wrote, but negotiations between Felt Productions, Incorporated and a group of Spanish investors were not successful. At that point further development of the exhibition was terminated. 43, a clandestine space program. In October 2010, Simon Worden, as director, NASA Ames, revealed a joint project with DARPA, Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, called the 100-Year Starship. The human space program is now really aimed at settling other worlds, he explained. 20 years ago you had to whisper that in dark bars and get fired. He went on to mention some nearer-term projects that NASA is exploring, not necessarily related to the Starship program, one of which was electric propulsion. Anybody that watches the Star Trek Enterprise, you know you don't see huge plumes of fire, Worden added. Within a few years we will see the first true prototype of a spaceship that will take us between worlds. 44 But as Lockheed Skunk Works genius Ben Rich had declared, during a lecture at the UCLA School of Engineering as far back as 1993, we already have the means to travel among the stars. 45, in the late 1980s, the electric propulsion study was conducted by Science Applications International Corporation, SAIC, a leading U.S. civil and military R&D company, for the Astronautics Laboratory, later part of the Phillips Laboratory, currently merged into the Air Force Research Laboratory's Space Vehicles Directorate. The study's primary objective was to outline physical methods to test theories of inductive coupling between electromagnetic and gravitational forces to determine the feasibility of such methods as they apply to space propulsion. In simplified terms, an anti-gravity propulsion system. 46. In his groundbreaking book Secrets of Anti-Gravity Propulsion, physicist Paul LaViolette recounts much information acquired from sources knowledgeable about Project Sky Vault, a highly classified program set up in the early 1950s to develop exotic propulsion technology. One of these sources, Tom, stated that NASA is essentially a public relations organization or a front that obscures Air Force space research. Tom had served with the Civil Air Patrol, CAP, and had been the recipient of the prestigious Michelson Award, as a result of which he was selected in 1963 to represent Idaho, together with CAP representatives from all the other states, to visit Chanute Air Force Base, Rantoul, Illinois. One day, about eight generals appeared on stage in an auditorium for a no-holds-barred question and answer session. A representative asked about Air Force Major Donald E. Kehoe, who had been censored for his pioneering books on UFOs and outspoken comments in the media. One of the generals responded that they had a way of taking care of people who gave out a little too much information, LaViolette relates. He said they would use physical injury or whatever was necessary to make them shut up, indicating they would kill a person, extreme prejudice, if you will. Someone else started to ask more about UFOs. One of the generals said the United States had a defense system in place at the time that consisted of a number of satellites, in orbit not only around Earth, but also around Mercury, Venus, Mars, and a few other, more distant planets they couldn't talk about. He said the satellites together functioned as an early warning system, that they were afraid of the people out there because they didn't know very much about them. This satellite system was built to observe three possible sources: missiles that might come from the Soviet Union, missiles that might come from China, and intrusions of aliens coming in toward Earth. Someone asked why the generals are being so candid. According to Tom, one responded by saying, "If you want, you can go ahead and tell people what we've told you, but they're not going to believe you. Besides, if you did get anyone to believe you and they came back to ask us, we would just deny it. So we have nothing to lose by telling you this." 47. In the late 1950s, NASA was formed to compartmentalize, containerize, and sanitize information from all space platforms and vehicles, claimed John Lear to Art Bell in 2003. "We sold NASA to the public, claiming that all information would belong to them. But they got very little, and even that was highly sanitized." He added, "We set up operations in Pine Gap, Australia, to preclude any prying eyes figuring out what we were up to. We regularly eliminated with extreme prejudice anybody who was part of the operation and made the least little tiny threat about disclosure or dissatisfaction with the operation. Any space mission that included Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, Mariner, Voyager, Clementine, and all the rest, all the data initially came transmitted to Pine Gap, then it was relayed to JPL or wherever, after sanitizing. We had a little trouble with amateur radio operators, but we figured out how they were able to intercept these signals, and managed to deal with that." 48. Paul LaViolette also learned from Tom about rumors indicating that the world's first satellite was launched, not by the Soviet Union in 1957, but by the United States in 1948, using a modified V-2 rocket. He also indicated that, independent of NASA, the U.S. Air Force has its own shuttle fleet, allegedly launched from Johnston Island AFP in the Pacific Ocean, 717 nautical miles, or 823 statute miles, west-southwest of Honolulu. From 1976 to 1978, while working for the Air Force, Tom learned from a captain who had just returned from the island that the United States already had a base on the moon. The captain said that from looking at the cargo manifest for one of these shuttle launchings, one could conclude that provisions were routinely being shipped out, reports LaViolette. This was several years after the Apollo program had been terminated, the last Apollo mission having been completed in December 1972. 49. In this connection, President Ronald Reagan makes an intriguing observation in his diary entry for June 11, 1985. Lunch was with five top space scientists. It was fascinating. Space truly is the last frontier, and some of the developments there in astronomy etc. are like science fiction, except they are real. I learned that our shuttle capacity is such that we could orbit 300 people. 50. The last space shuttle flight took place in July 2011. Meanwhile, according to an officially approved leak in November 2011, China intends to launch up to 20 spacecraft in the next 10 years, at a cost of about $50 billion. Furthermore, it plans to build orbiting laboratory modules and a manned space station. While the Chinese media and leaders speak with one voice about China's peaceful development in space, the US is not so sure, reports British journalist Michael Sheridan, adding that America has no plans for manned space missions following the last space shuttle flight. 51. Which is far from the truth. In May 2012, the second demonstration mission for NASA's Commercial Orbital Transportation Services, COTS, program took place when Space Exploration Technologies, SpaceX, Falcon 9 rocket and Dragon spacecraft lifted off from Cape Canaveral Air Force Station. Today marks the beginning of a new era in exploration, declared NASA Administrator Charles Bolden. A private company has launched a spacecraft to the International Space Station, ISS, that will attempt to dock there for the first time. Under President Obama's leadership, the nation is embarking upon an ambitious exploration program that will take us farther into space than we have ever traveled before. 52. Dragon successfully completed key on-orbit tests, including docking with the ISS. SpaceX aims to begin sending astronauts to the space station by 2015. In the meantime, the world's astronauts will rely on Russia's Soyuz for ISS transport, at a cost of $63 million per seat. 53. It is my belief that U.S. Air Force Space Command, AFSPC, is in charge of a clandestine space program. I also remain convinced by the claims of Gary McKinnon, arrested in 2002 for having hacked with relative ease into numerous classified U.S. military networks, including that of AFSPC, searching for information relating to UFOs, for which he long faced extradition to the United States, vetoed in 2012 by Britain's Home Secretary. While studying AFSPC data, Gary uncovered a list of officers' names under the heading non-terrestrial officers. What I think it means is, not Earth-based, he explained. I found a list of fleet-to-fleet transfers and a list of ship names. I looked them up. They weren't U.S. Navy ships. 54. On finding the first image on my PC, Gary told me in 2006, the Earth, or at least a blue and white planet with no continents visible, filled two-thirds of the screen. Midway between the camera and the planet hung a cigar-shaped object with geodesic domes above, below, and to the left and right. I didn't see any rivets, seams, or telemetry antennae. Chapter 15, Technology Transfer. On returning from the United States to his native Germany in 1959, following 3 years of studying information on alien spacecraft supplied by his own and other governments, the outspoken pioneer Professor Hermann Oberth revealed to newsmen waiting for him at the Frankfurt airport that there was a worldwide effort to learn how anti-gravity could be put to use as a form of energy, adding that he expected men would be traveling to the moon in electrically driven devices within 5 to 10 years. 1. Captain Billiouse served 10 years as a fighter pilot in the U.S. Marine Corps, then 4 years with the U.S. Air Force as a civilian at Wright-Patterson AFB, flight testing exotic aircraft, including, he claims, flying discs. While I was at Wright-Patterson, he told Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project in 2000, they had selected several of us, and they reassigned me to A-Link Aviation, which was a simulator manufacturer. At that time, they were building what they called the Link C-11B jet flight trainer, and F-102 simulator, B-47 simulator, and so forth. They wanted us to get experienced before we actually started work on the flying disc simulator, which I spent 30-some years working on. I don't think any flying disc simulators went into operation until the early 1960s, around 1962 or 1963. The simulator that they used was for the extraterrestrial craft they had, which is a 30-meter one that crashed in Kingman, Arizona, back in 1953.2. That's the first one that they took out to the test flight.